is simple perfection. There's nothing that's harder to find. Someone to lead us, protect us and feed us, and help us to make up our minds. We need a man that's sophisticated, quiet and strong and well educated. Where to go? What to do? Could it be somebody super like you?
Hello to all you guys and gals, and welcome again to Bazaar Bazaar. I'd like to wish you all a happy Casimir Pulaski Day, as I am doing this show, and it is after midnight. Therefore, let the festivities begin. Now, what exactly is Casimir Pulaski Day, you might be asking yourself? Well, exactly, precisely, I don't know. But I know it's got to do with Chicago, and the Polish folks go nuts for it here. I know traffic is light as many stay home from work, and I know I don't get any mail. And that's about it. But hey, I'm nothing if not civic-minded, and I'm a local boy born and raised here, so let's celebrate. Hooray for Casimir Pulaski. Hooray for Chicago! Whoop-dee-fucking-doo!
Yeah. What kind of a name is Stivic? Where you from?
Chicago.
I mean, where are your people from?
They're from Poland.
That will make you Polish then, huh?
Yeah. Let me tell you something, Mr. Bunker.
No, let me tell you something, Mr. Stivic. You are a meathead.
What did you call me?
A meathead. Dead from the neck up. Meathead.
Oh, yeah, now I see what your idea of a free country is. You're free to say anything you want, but if anyone disagrees with you, they're either thrown into jail or called a meathead, right?
That's right, because this is American land that I love.
Well, I love it too, Mr. Bunker, and it's because I do it, I protest when I think things are wrong.
And stand beside her. And guide her.
The right to dissent is the principle upon which this country was based.
With the light from above.
Listen to me. It's in the Bill of Rights.
From the mountains.
Why do you think we broke away from England
prairies,
to begin with, huh? Because we didn't agree
oceans,
with them. We demanded
why
freedom.
Why would fall?
Gee, it's guys like you. It's guys like you. We're all missing a reason. I mean, you're not listening
America,
to anything. You're totally
you
closed-minded.
Hold on. Sweet home.
She comes from Kansas City in the middle of the land. She was the queen of the game, but love never came with a man.
Most, roller derby probably hit your pop cultural radar during the early 70s, but it actually was born right here in Chicago during the Depression. Of course, then it was more of an endurance race as opposed to the sport it would later become. In 1949, the National Roller Derby League was formed and became the basis of the next generational onslaught of a sport that welcomed and instilled a sense of gender unity as men and women skated on the same team. In 1971, the sport went nationwide. Thousands of fans watched the Chicago Pioneers, the Cincinnati Jolters, the New York Chiefs, LA T-Birds, and perhaps the most popular of them all, the Bay City Bombers. So with the combination of the sex appeal of tight-bodied young women and men, I suppose, and the violent, agonizing Roman gladiator-style arena that whipped its legions of loyal fans into a frenzy, derby was rolling right along. So it only made sense that Hollywood would now take notice and step in. News got out that MGM was looking to do a huge blockbuster for the summer of 1972, featuring the wiles of a sumptuous Raquel Welch. The trade papers hopped all over it. The industry was excited to see what MGM and this first-time director Gerald Freeman were going to come up with. The answer? Kansas City Bomber. This film had Raquel as derby star Casey Carr and basically follows her trials and tribulations, her ups and downs, her loves and losses as she goes from team to team in hopes of catching the big break into stardom. With the word floating about, it didn't take long before B-movie king Roger Corman caught a whiff of what MGM had planned. and what was being touted as the biggest hit of 1972. Ever the opportunist, Corman put a cast and crew together to try and beat MGM to the punch, or at least ride the wave of hype that Miss Welsh was riding. This manifests itself into the film Unholy Rollers. Mimi Chesterton sounds like a made-up porn starlet's name if ever I heard one. But astonishingly, it was actually the lovely Claudia Jennings' Christian name. A straight-A student in high school, Mimi disappointed her parents with the rash announcement that she was dropping her academic life to become an actress/model. She found herself a dumpy apartment and began the typical hard life of any aspiring performer. Her first break was a receptionist gig at the offices of Playboy to make ends meet. She would eventually be asked to participate in a photo shoot, and in the November 1969 issue, the centerfold playmate is none other than our Mimi, now renamed for the sake of her young sisters. Despite her small to average sized rack, this green-eyed redhead would become one of the most popular playmates of the 70s, a decade obsessed with huge boobies. Mighty impressive. Some minor roles on TV would follow, and even an off-Broadway show landed in her lap as a result of her Playboy notoriety. Claudia then decided to find herself a reputed agent to represent her, and before long had landed the starring role in Unholy Rollers. One heaping helping of unabashedly pure drive-in exploitation fodder. And her first shot at stardom. I think the 1972 New York Times review of the film from Paul Brenner sums it up quite nicely. Karen becomes a hit with the roller derby fans, but soon her desire for victory becomes an obsession, and she ends up losing not only her cool, but most of her clothes. In 1978, some 5 years after Unholy Rollers, and after also starring in other essential 70s drive-in movies such as Gator Bait, Truck Stop Women, The Great Texas Dynamite Chase, and Death Sport, Claudia arrived in Toronto to star in David Cronenberg's drag racing film Fast Company. The consistently sleepy-looking actress was suffering from cocaine addiction by this point, but remained certain that she would be the one chosen to replace Kate Jackson on TV's Charlie's Angels, which instead went to little-known actress Shelley Hack. Claudia was grief-stricken and beside herself when she returned to L.A., and on October 3rd, 1979, at the ripe old age of 29, Claudia was sleeping while driving her VW Bug convertible on Topanga Canyon Boulevard. She was blindsided by a van and died at the scene. Now, roller derby's popularity peaked in 1972, and Kansas City Bomber and Unholy Rollers were right there to ride the wave and then get swept underneath it. It was only a year, but it was enough to give this very short-lived subgenre of exploitation a spot in film history. A tiny blaze of rolling glory, but one that deserves a nod. As for the roller derby leagues themselves, in 1973, merely 1 year after Raquel Welch and Claudia Jennings had brought their sport to the cover of Life magazine and theater screens across the country, the entire circuit was shut down, leaving derby relegated to occasional disorganized outings put on by amateurs. Most insiders pointed to the rising gas prices being to blame for killing off all the profits made by the constantly traveling teams. But it's also said that the sport had simply run its course with its fans. There were attempts in the 80s and 90s to bring the sport back, but all fell flat on their ass. But as the new millennium hit, roller derby saw a new resurgence, taking on a different form, being exclusively female this time around. And perhaps a different function. Leagues started popping up here and there, Texas, LA, Arizona, and so on, and would eventually start growing like wildfire. From what was a little seedling of a subcultural idea, has grown into hundreds of leagues throughout North and South America, Europe, Asia, Australia, etc., etc. Chicago fans are treated to the ever in contention for the coveted Hydra Trophy Windy City Rollers. This sport still flies under the mainstream radar, but its grassroots sense of camaraderie and community are what make it unique, and what has helped build up a very loyal and rabid fan base of its own. Now, of course, ladies donning the fishnets and war paint to go out and beat the crap out of each other doesn't hurt either. So thank you, Chicago, for spawning this sport. But mucho gracias to the sleazy 70s American culture that developed it into something spectacular. Only in this milieu could something so wrong become something so right.
Ah!
damage.
So, what was the important news you couldn't tell me on the phone again?
Well, I started thinking about what you were saying, about how your movies need to make a profit. Now, what is the one thing, if you put it in a movie, it'll be successful?
Tits.
No, better than that. A star.
Hey, you must have me confused with David Selznick. I don't make major motion pictures. I make crap.
Yes, but if you take that crap and put a star in it, then you've got something.
Yeah, crap with a star.
No, something better. Something impressive. Maybe the biggest moneymaker you've ever had.
Fine, all right. You may be right, but it doesn't frickin' matter. I can't afford a star, so what are we even talking about?
All right. What if I told you you could have a star for $1,000?
Who? Lugosi?
Yes, Lugosi.
Isn't he dead?
In October 1882, in a small town in Hungary, Bela Blasco was born. But you undoubtedly know him better by his stage name, Bela Lugosi. Now, Bela did a lot of work, but let's face it, the guy was fucking Dracula. And let's just leave it at that. In 1956, it wasn't the spike to the heart that got this old vamp, but the spike he drove into his own veins that eventually led to his heart failure and death at the age of 73. In 1979, the band Bauhaus released the single Bela Lugosi Is Dead, sort of an elegy for the old bloodsucker. The song in turn became sort of a gothic rock anthem, a sort of icon in its own rights. Now in 1986, Chicago-based punk band ID Under released an EP which included a track entitled Bela Lugosi's Not Dead, You Are. Seemingly a shot at the gods of goth as they had broken up earlier in 1983. Now this sentiment could simply be a commentary on how Bella, despite being dead for years, is still an easily identifiable icon, while your band is dead and buried. Or it could have been interpreted as an all-encompassing slam to the subgenre of gothic rock, claiming it to be dead. Now if that ain't the punk calling the kettle black. Now I'm not here to pick sides. I mean, I suppose both make valid points. One was right figuratively, and one was right literally. So be that as it may, all I gotta say on the subject is R.I.P. you old slamhead.
Well, Bela Lugosi's not dead, you are. Bela Lugosi's not dead, you are. You're still 8-16, and you think you're fucking me. You think those drummers great, but you've already seen your fight. Bela Lugosi's not dead, you are. Bela Lugosi's not dead, you are. Not dead, you are. Bela Lugosi's not dead, you are. Bela Lugosi's not dead, you are. Bela Lugosi's not dead, you are. We'll
In the winter of 85-86, Chicago film director John McNaughton, on a budget of $125K, filmed a movie about a pathological mass murderer that was told in such flat, unforgiving realism that it inspired many an angry debate after screenings at film festivals and midnight showings here in Chicago, and other limited Midwest releases. Mired in the movie rating system for years, it wasn't until 1989 that the rest of the country finally got to see Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. It's a chilling film that, fair warning, will horrify many viewers and is intended to illuminate, not entertain. But it also is a very good film. A low-budget tour de force that provides an unforgettable portrait of the pathology of a man for whom killing is not a crime, but simply a way of passing the time and relieving boredom. Using unknown actors from the freewheeling Organic Theater Company and loosely inspired by the confessions of a self-described mass murderer named Henry Lucas, the film uses a slice-of-life approach to create a docudrama of chilling horror. Now, unlike typical slasher movies, Henry does not employ humor, campy in-jokes, or a colorful anti-hero. Filmed in the gray slush and wet winter nights of Chicago's back alleys, honky-tonk bars, and drab apartments, it tells of a drifter who kills strangers. Efficiently, and without remorse. The movie contains scenes of heartless and shocking violence committed by characters who seem to lack the ordinary feelings of common humanity. Henry drifted in a cinematic no man's land after it was first seen publicly in a video version at the 1986 Chicago Film Festival, but it couldn't gain any mass distribution without an R rating, which it simply wasn't going to get without substantial cuts made to the movie. Organic Theater veteran Tom Towles plays the equally chilling role of Otis, a casual friend who drifts into murder. And Tracy Arnold is Otis's sister, a teenage stripper who knows Henry killed his mother and finds the fact intriguing. Now in the film, Henry becomes the roommate of Otis, a parolee working in a gas station, and then the sister arrives from out of town and moves in. She is fascinated by Henry's stories of violence. Otis, who may have a homosexual interest in Henry, eventually goes along with him in a series of brutal killings, including one where they pretend to have car trouble and then shoot a Good Samaritan, and another where they invade a home and videotape the murder of an entire family. The videotape scene appalls many viewers, but at least it shows Henry dealing honestly with its subject matter, instead of trying to sugarcoat violence as most slasher films do. Now, some say the film Henry is too violent and disgusting to be endured. Others say it is justified because of its uncompromising honesty in a world where most horror films cheapen death by trivializing it. The division seems to be between those who feel the film does its job brilliantly and those who feel its job should not have been done at all.
Fucking Betsy, man. What? It's coming up. What? In
the William! Fucking... William!
Dude, I'm so there. Dude. So there.
Somebody. Say that again. I'd like like to kill somebody. That's when you go for a ride. I'd like to kill somebody. Say that again. I'd like to kill somebody. That's when you go for a ride. It's always the same. Somebody. That's when you go for a ride. We'll be right back.
I suppose it would be remiss of me if I ended a show without briefly talking about Chicago's Wax Trax Records, the store, and the eventual label, especially since it was so vital to the underground scene at the time, not to mention yours truly and this very show. In 1978, Jim Nash and Danny Flesher moved their record shop from Denver to Chicago. 2449 North Lincoln Avenue would become the epicenter of the punk, industrial, and new wave scenes here in the city. The store itself was a haven for those of us looking for super cool music and rare records that you just couldn't get anywhere else. It became a meeting place for those in the know. And there was, truthfully, most likely way more loitering and hanging than actual patronizing, but Jim and Danny never had a problem with it and never made those feel unwelcome. Now, the evolution from store to label was a gradual process. The first official release was Strike Under's Immediate Action EP in 1980. The artists to follow are a who's who of the scene. Front 242, Frontline Assembly, KMFDM, My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult, Meat Beat Manifesto, Cubanate, Liebach, Sister Machine Gun, Ministry, and just about all of Al Jorgensen and Paul Barker's side projects, of which Trent Reznor, Ian McKay, Jello Biafra, Chris Conley were a part, just to name a few. Now, with the burgeoning scene's HQ being the store, the surrounding neighborhood witnessed a hostile takeover of sorts, but more out of default than design. See, Wax Trax was located just south of the city's gay neighborhood. There were a couple different coach houses in the area that served as both practice spaces and dwellings for many in the punk scene. So the location became a blending, a haven for punks, goths, rivet heads, drag queens, gays, and whatever dregs felt like wandering in at that time. We were the outcasts that no other neighborhoods wanted. So we all came together as a form of survival. But it really was more communal than you'd think. Berlin and Spin, two clubs that were the heartbeat of the gay scene at the time, started having industrial goth nights. Medusa's had three floors, and on any night you could see a punk band, a DJ spinning industrial, an emo electric synth pop band, and hardcore skinheads stomping all over the place. El Gato Negro was sort of a gothy tranny bar that spun industrial and gothic. Lucky Number became overran with and eventually taken over by us. It was formerly an old Ukrainian working man's place. So if you can imagine Archie Bunker rubbing elbows with mohawked punks and goths, you kind of get the idea. And just up the street from Wax Trax was possibly the Studio 54 of our scene, Crash Palace. Although now you might know it better as Delilah's. This is where everyone went. And numerous Wax Trackers would DJ and play their favorite shit. It was the scene. The tale is even told that this is where Kurt Cobain first met Courtney Love. According to Cynthia Plasticaster, and true or no, I don't know if that's really anything to boast about. You could even see a very slight floppy-haired Billy Corgan and James Iha standing, folded-armed, trying very hard to be seen not being seen, if you catch my drift. And you may ask yourself, how did a fella in his late teens, early 20s get into all these clubs and bars? Well, apparently you haven't been paying attention. This was 80s Chicago. Nobody gave a damn. Most of the places were staffed with others of the scene. The guys working the doors were friends of mine. Bartenders were boyfriends and girlfriends. And if there was an issue, the cops didn't give a fuck. They were too busy shaking down dealers for cash and free dope, or getting blown from ladyboys. And it ain't slander if it's the fucking truth. And anyone who lived around Belmont and Halsted can attest to that. Oh, the stories those back decks could tell. We'd have to check our shoes to make sure there weren't condoms sticking onto them before going into people's apartments. Yeah, I could go on and on, and look how you've gotten me off track again. Of course, I'm just scratching the surface. Eventually, financial problems and the death of Jim Nash led to its unfortunate demise. The store eventually moved from its Lincoln location to a much smaller store on Damon. And by the mid-90s, it was closed altogether. There were numerous reasons for its closing, with a little bit of everyone to blame. But during its run, it was the Mecca. As integral as Chess Records was to blues and soul, so was Wax Trax to industrial punk and new wave. And just a quick bit of trivia. It is often mistakenly thought that Wax Trax was the record store used in Pretty in Pink. And I could see the confusion, but here's the deal. John Hughes was a big fan of Wax Trax and wanted to use the Lincoln location as the set for the record store in the flick. Now, they did come in with cameras and crew and the trucks and the whole deal. But there was some nitpicky Hollywood issues with the layout, so they just packed up and built the set on some LA studio lot. However, they had Wax Trax send them all the props to fill the set. You know, records, posters, stickers, t-shirts, and so on. You know, typical. And in typical Hollywood fashion, even the name was whittled down to just Trax. From Fullerton to Irving, Western to the Lake, like the Flower Children's Hate Nashberry, this was our hood. Real quick, I just remember the original pressing of that Acid Horse single. It came with a sheet of blotter paper and the name of the band being a play on both the slang terms for LSD and heroin. It was just a plain sheet of blotter with no LSD on it whatsoever. But some people you just couldn't convince. They'd swear up and down they took it and were tripping balls. It got so out of hand that I do believe they stopped releasing it with the sheet because of parents complaining and so on. Ah, the power of suggestion and what folks want to believe. Anyway, let's wrap this up properly now. Okay, well, once again, the time has come to bid a fond adieu to you, the BFAF Nation. But before I go, I'd like to take this opportunity to give some parting words and perhaps dispel a few myths about this fine city and its residents. First off, we do not eat deep dish pizza. It was created here, true. But only tourists keep eating this shit and keep the restaurants that boasted alive. Second, the Willises can go take a flying leap. It's the Sears Tower, and always will be. We do not look like, talk like, or give a shit about Mike Ditka. The orange-faced wonder had his time, and that was 1986. Now he and his drunken delinquent offspring can go dancing arm in arm off Navy Pier and into Lake Michigan for all I care. And Jim Belushi, John Cusack, Vince Vaughn, all about as Chicago and as the Eiffel Tower, these three can also join the Ditkas. Now, highest taxes in the nation, soaring murder rates, a furlough program for our governors, and well, that part's all true, but hey, what can I tell you? Chicago, it's my kind of town. Goodbye to you.
Next, the blind will see and the lame will walk.